You're listening to Robert Wright's Non-Zero Podcast.
Hello, this is Bob. I just want to let you know, especially if you're someone who follows this AI stuff closely, that this conversation was taped right before the whole Anthropic fable Trump administration brouhaha. But our discussion of Anthropic's mythos, which as some of you know, is the unguardrailed version of fable, is somewhat relevant to this still unsettled Trump fable issue. And in any event, in this conversation, we mostly talk about other equally topical AI issues, like, very importantly, recursive self-improvement, also known as, is the singularity near? So I hope you enjoy the conversation, and needless to say, should you decide to rate and review us, or smash the like button on YouTube, or subscribe to the YouTube channel, or subscribe to the Non-Zero newsletter, or in any other way support this enterprise, we would very much appreciate it. Thanks. Hello, Ryan.
Hey, Bob.
How you doing?
I'm doing okay. How are you?
You know, I'm doing fine because I'm very interested in what we're going to talk about. Let me introduce us first. My name is Robert Wright. I'm publisher of the Non-Zero newsletter. This is a Non-Zero podcast. You are Ryan Fedushek. No, wait, did I get that wrong after asking you how to pronounce it? Tell me the
you
truth.
You did, but that's okay. I'll
okay, let's hear it from the horse's mouth. Say your last name.
Fedushek.
See, it's spelled wrong on the thing I'm looking at. This is my excuse.
That might be it, actually.
Don't ask me who wrote the thing I'm looking at. I don't want to get into that. But anyway, it's Fedushek. And and you are at the American Enterprise Institute. For one thing, you are an adjunct professor at Georgetown University. You're author of the Substack Choosing Victory, which describes you as an analyst covering China, technology, and national power, which is good because there's a lot happening at the intersection of those things. I mean, for starters, there's the chip control, the chip export restrictions, which I think you're a supporter of. There was recently the development of this Mythos AI model, which raises the prospect of maybe the U.S. having this big cyber warfare advantage. I don't know. I'll ask you about that. Also raised the prospect of like third party, like non-state actors, doing malicious things. That may have been some of the impetus for the announcement that the U.S. and China are going to be having an AI safety dialogue, which is a very interesting development in its own right, I think. And then finally, Anthropic, arguably the leading AI lab, certainly at worst neck and neck with OpenAI in terms of the latest models, recently released this paper that talked about how fast research was accelerating at Anthropic, raised the possibility of reaching so-called recursive self-improvement, which we'll get into, I think, roughly synonymous with the singularity, although they didn't use that term. And they raise the possibility of eventually a global pause on AI development or major AI training or something. That got people's attention. I mean, the announcement wasn't as dramatic as some of the headlines made it sound like. I mean, what Anthropic actually said, they weren't proposing that we do that now. But still, there's a lot going on. And I'm wondering, for starters, what do you think of this? What do you think of the whole Anthropic thing? There were these two big dimensions. You know, first, the recursive self-improvement thing, which basically refers to the point where they just take the humans out of the AI development loop, I guess, and the models, you know, which are already doing a non-trivial part of the process of developing AI. They just do the whole thing. They just keep improving themselves, and we sit there and watch to see what happens. And this is what led Anthropic at the end of this to ask whether we might start thinking about the possibility that eventually a global pause will be a good idea. What do you think of that whole thing?
Sure, lots to unpack. I mean, first of all, I'm a believer in the potential for recursive self-improvement. I think almost every lab these days in San Francisco is talking about it and seized with making their teams use it. This has been the case for, you know, more than the past 6 months, and certainly since the release of Mythos or 5.5 Cyber for ChatGPT, that's starting to look like it could be reality, at least based on what the labs are sharing publicly. So already it was the case that model releases had been shortening in the window between when they come online. And I think that that's going to continue being the case faster and faster.
Mm-hmm. It has been. Now, are you using a strict definition of recursive self-improvement where, like, really, there are no humans in the loop? I mean, that's kind of scary sounding. And that was the, I think, the premise for talking about a global pause, because you might think that the system has, in some sense, escaped human control at that point. But are you, because it seems to me like that, strictly speaking, may still be a ways off. It clearly is the case that the AIs themselves are playing a larger role in the development of the next generation. You know, I think this started in a significant way with the coding capabilities of the AIs, but Anthropic makes it sound like they're also playing a role now in kind of conducting experiments about what approaches to AI might work, and maybe even conceiving some of the experiments. But anyway, are you imagining, like, really no humans necessary development of generation after generation of AI, or are you speaking more loosely when you say that recursive self-improvement is a real possibility?
I'm mostly speaking more loosely. I think there are some structural safeguards in place just in the way that companies are operating and the way the technology is being developed that will necessitate some level of human oversight. But certainly it's the case that, you know, people are deploying AI at higher and higher levels of abstraction and asking it for more open-ended, more creative inputs on the one hand. I think there are a few ways of kind of thinking about what this looks like at the technical level. And frankly, you know, as somebody who hasn't worked at a lab, I'm maybe not the best person to talk about this, but I do use coding agents pretty frequently and all kinds of harness setups. And it's already the case that you can spin up multiple instances of an agent to talk to one another, to have that adversarial feedback loop and try to create, you know, newer, cooler, faster, more efficient systems. That's something that almost every software developer is doing already. Mm-hmm. And so it just really depends on the parameters you put around what's called a cron job, kind of an automated open-ended task, do X every, you know, interval of time Y. And so if you ask for modular improvements or marginal improvements to processes that you specify, then you can probably automate a lot of the work that's done by a human software engineer to try to make a more efficient AI model. You can also, as you've articulated and as the Anthropic paper, you know, intimated, you could kind of create all kinds of experimental outcomes and decisions and say, optimize for X outcome, you know, try to think outside the box, think creatively, and just see what this intelligent system decides to do and how to approach the problem.
When you said adversarial, you mean in the sense of discourse. In other words, one model says, well, the trouble with your idea is blank. How about this idea? It's like debating.
Yeah, exactly. It's a cacophony of ideas being, you know, put forward by models in parallel.
And what's a practical example of how, if I understand you correctly, you are using that dynamic in your own work?
Sure. I mean, I kind of do a bunch of things. My main job is as a researcher at the American Enterprise Institute. And so just for a normal research task, right, if I need a background paper on something I don't know much about, if I'm going to go meet a foreign mission from a company that I, or from a country that I don't focus on, I'll just say like Vietnam, then maybe I'll ask for a background paper on US-Vietnam relations from Google Gemini. And then I'll run this paper through ChatGPT and say, tell me all the mistakes that I made or that Gemini made. Tell me some areas of improvement for this paper. And then I'll get feedback from ChatGPT. And then I'll send that system to DeepSeek and say, pretend you're a senior Chinese diplomat and you're, you know, offering China's view of US-Vietnam relations, what would you add to this paper? And then you get kind of a mixture of experts that you're simulating in your own kind of network that add value at every step of the way. Yeah. You can automate this process now with agents that are instances of an AI system with persistent memory that last across sessions, and ask them to repeatedly execute the same task at a specified interval. And they basically operate as research assistants that never sleep. So that's one application I use for my work at AEI. I also run a small startup called Digital Embassy, where I'm trying to aggregate news from around the world every day, from almost every piece of published information in 22 countries and growing, to kind of replicate the work of State Department diplomats around the world and write cables every day where they're located. And so I have, you know, teams of agents that are refining one another's diplomatic cables coming out of Moscow and Beijing and Tehran and capitals around the world every day.
So these are reports that, in theory, are the kind of reports that would be issued from those perspectives. Like, this is the way maybe this particular issue looks from the point of view of Moscow, or?
They're written from the perspective of a diplomat that's situated in country. So I used to work at the State Department, and I used to write summaries of what was going on with respect to China. And so I trained my AI system to write and think like me and kind of summarize the news, how I would summarize the news automatically every day from every country.
Right. But you mentioned earlier when we were talking about the adversarial exchange among models, one prompt being, so how, if you're like, you know, in Beijing or whatever, how do you respond to this report that this other model generated? That seems to me to be a very valuable thing that I'd like to see more of. I mean, I my own view is that American foreign policy has not been informed as much as might have been optimal by an understanding of how things look from outside of, for example, America. And we're kind of famous for that, I think. We're more famous than we know around the world. That seems like it could be a great thing. I mean, I've talked actually to people at Non-Zero, the newsletter I put out, about working on something like that, kind of a cognitive empathy tool, you might say, just a perspective-taking tool. But it sounds like you sometimes do make use of something like that.
Definitely. And if I can add just a little note here, it's a little bit of pseudoscience at this point. We don't have a good descriptive benchmark to delineate between how different models behave personality-wise, but certainly any, like, your users and surely you, Bob, have used, you know, OpenAI's ChatGPT and Anthropic's Claude, and they feel different, right? They've got a different flavor or texture to them. It feels like you're talking to a different person if you come to each of them with questions. And so my kind of mental model of the world is, you know, based on the regulations that have started to creep up in China, for example, that some of the Chinese systems also have gradations in how those models behave from one another. And certainly, you know, DeepSeek or Qwen is going to be super different from Claude. And so I code DeepSeek and Qwen for specific tasks that demand that kind of level of strategic empathy you're talking about. I don't know if there's anything really there.
So you're kind of assuming a Chinese model is better at looking things from the Chinese point of view.
That's my theory.
It's not crazy. I mean, the training data, to the extent that it is biased toward a given nation, will naturally do that. I think there's actually some evidence in recent AI research that you should expect that.
Certainly, we know it happens. I mean, politically and for the policy world, it matters a lot. I just wrote an article about China's approach to AI regulation and governance with Audrey Wong, my colleague at AEI, in War on the Rocks a couple of weeks ago. And we walked through some of the different regulations in China about how AI systems are actually trained. And, you know, the landmark regulation, TC260, eliminates sensitive training data sets. And so this is why DeepSeek and other models have different outputs qualitatively than anything you would find in the United States, because they're restricted on what data they can train on.
That's interesting. So Okay, so this, maybe we'll get back to the recursive self-improvement thing. In any event, I personally have a sense of acceleration just from the rate at which stuff is happening. Anthropic did raise the possibility, very tentatively, actually, that a global pause is worth talking about, made the point that you would need some kind of monitoring system to make sure that any pause is being respected by other actors. The U.S. and China would both want that. And that raises questions about the technical feasibility of monitoring. But before we get to that, can you imagine a pause making sense at some point from anyone's point of view, I guess, us, including the world's, including America's?
This is a huge question. I mean, how do you even go about breaking it down? Could I imagine it could make sense at some point? I mean, sure, absolutely. I mean, so did certain arms control provisions during the Cold War, right? And certainly it wouldn't make sense during the Cold War for the United States and China to develop thousands of nuclear weapons capable of annihilating the world many, many times over. And yet that is what happened. And you know, I don't mean to pour cold water on this policy paper, which is a serious bid from Anthropic. And I'm really glad that people are starting to think and talk that way, because if everybody said it would be impossible, then that would preclude the possibility outright. But I am, you know, forgive me for being a skeptic. As somebody who spent thousands of hours across the table from Chinese diplomats, I just don't think it's going to happen. And we could talk a little bit more about why. Go ahead.
So it's not the technical feasibility question so much with you as to whether the actual will exists on the Chinese side. Because, I mean, to get back to perspective taking, I would be surprised if what you just said about Chinese attitudes isn't mirrored in China about American attitudes. I mean, we are, by all appearances, from their point of view, hell-bent on beating them in this race. I mean, we're restricting the chips. You know, I'm sure you're familiar with Dario Amodei's, the head of Anthropic's own writing about kind of geopolitics, which is very, I don't think it's unfair to say he wants to bring China to its knees with AI superiority, maybe a little unfair. But anyway, if you're in China, wouldn't you think, wouldn't you have trouble believing that America, which is in the lead after all, is actually could be serious about a pause?
Yeah, I take your point, right? I mean, there was a reason why the SALT talks between the U.S. and the Soviet Union didn't happen in the 50s when the U.S. was the unparalleled world superpower in nuclear technology. They took place in the 70s after mm-hmm. the development of MIRV and technologies that could really put the Soviets in an advantage.
That was the independent warheads, right? So a rocket having multiple warheads. Right. Okay.
Right. I mean, the bottom line, the U.S. wasn't willing to come to the table to serious arms control discussions until there was a reason to do so. You know, that's currently the case in nuclear weapons with China, which sees no reason to engage in serious arms control discussions that bond the United States and Russia.
China's behind now in nuclear weapons, and they'd like to catch up a little before.
They would love to catch up, and they see no reason to participate in any kind of arms control discussion. Until they do, right? At least that's been very clear in their actions and attitudes. And so in AI, it's a similar question. It depends on who you talk to in the United States. If you ask me, right, like I don't think we should sacrifice our current lead or first mover advantage. I would think that an agreement to some kind of pause in research and development would be deleterious to the United States, right? I worry about Chinese cheating, just like I worry about Russian cheating on arms control, which we know happened and is likely to happen. So there are lots of threads we can pull on here. Verification is a necessary precursor to any kind of orchestrated pause. I don't know how feasible that is. And frankly, unlike with nuclear weapons, which can be counted safely from space in a domain that we have all kind of agreed is openly traversable, trying to verify workload usage by looking at thermals and looking at other, you know, signatures of a cluster of computer chips in the data center are a lot more sensitive and harder to do at scale reliably. And so I'm not sure how technically feasible it even is.
Yeah, Anthropic in the paper made it sound a lot harder than nuke verification. I had heard that if you're just talking about the major training runs that are now used to develop a new frontier model, there's so many chips consuming so much power that that would probably be doable. I don't know if they had in mind, you know, regularized, what kind of monitoring they had in mind. My sense was they were saying that, you know, you wouldn't even need any special access from China. If you're paying attention with satellites and stuff, you'll know if they're doing anything like Anthropic, like this Elon Musk cluster, what's it called, Colossus 2.
Right.
You know, what is it? 500,000 super high performance chip guzzles energy. It'd be hard to hide something like that. Is that not your sense?
I mean, at a technical level, certainly that is true, right? We're talking about dozens to hundreds to thousands, probably not thousands, but, you know, probably like on the order of 10 to 20 gigawatts to train a frontier system from scratch today. That takes thousands of leading edge AI accelerators operating for months on end. So that's the equivalent power draw of, I think, maybe a small city over the period of a month. And so that's something you would detect if you know how to detect national technical means. So theoretically, it is possible. If we want to open the door to a verification regime to globally monitor compute usage, that is going to invite a constant chicken and egg, hide the ball game, like we have seen play out with nuclear weapons over the past century. And it's going to be hard. And it's going, and I guess the lesson, the main takeaway that I have is, you know, not only will it be hard, it will require, I think, a level of invasiveness and visibility that people are not accustomed to voluntarily sharing. And so that is what is different, maybe, about trying to monitor AI workloads vice nuclear weapons.
Yeah, no, I agree. Certainly, if it becomes a very fine-grained thing, you're going to need unprecedented levels of access. And for that reason, I think we're going to have to take that into account in our engineering of relations with China, especially, that maybe it's just more and more in our interest to try to foster a warmer relationship. But the reason I think that is because I can imagine like a lot of bad stuff happening with this technology. And I'm curious as to your view of that. I mean, you know, the things I'd cite as reasons to really think seriously about unprecedented kind of agreements of international governance are, first of all, the things you hear about. You know, that AIs maybe make it easier for somebody to build a bioweapon, maybe even a non-state actor who is making use of models developed by state. I mean, we'll get into the open source issue later, but that certainly opens a lot of doors, and that's the kind of model China is building now. Then Mythos, of course, focus people's attention on the possibility of a kind of a super hacking machine. And there have long been these visions of like a self-replicating AI super hacker that jumps from data center, commandeers the compute, and, you know, whatever. Seems like that's not totally crazy. And then there, you know, Anthropic was raising questions about, well, no, they weren't quite. They were raising questions about loss of control, which I think are not, don't deserve to be dismissed and are harder to completely dismiss than you might think. I also have worries about just the sheer pace of change having a really disruptive effect on society along a number of dimensions, you know, jobs, child rearing, education, you know, dislocating so many people and traditions in so many ways that you just get a destabilizing effect. And I'm not sure our country is really built to resist much more internal destabilization than it's seen lately. But so I would say, I'm wondering how you feel about that, about the idea that, in a way, this is a much more challenging thing than nuclear weapons. I mean, after all, with nuclear weapons, there was just the deterrent effect, you know, of knowing that you'll get blown up if, you know, you launch a nuclear war. As you suggested, every once in a while, a challenge to that logic would show up, such as the multiple warheads. Another one was defensive missiles that could shoot, you know, if one country had enough of a defensive arsenal to neutralize a first attack, then the other country could start worrying that the country with the defensive missiles could launch a first attack and be impervious to reprisal. And, you know, I think one of the really impressive things in the history of humankind is the decision to actually have a treaty about those defensive missiles and say, well, let's just nobody build them. They're destabilizing. We did that for a while. And then George W. Bush chose to get out of that. But I was kind of impressed anyway. But my larger point is, in a way, nuclear weapons were an easy case. First of all, verification, according to Anthropic, was easier, as challenging as it may have been. But also, you had this naturally stabilizing dynamic, and it was almost like you just had to make sure that nothing happened that disrupted the natural stabilization of mutual deterrence. This seems more. Do you agree that this is really, you know, 2, 3, 4, 5 years down the road, we have some very profound challenges here that cannot be addressed at the level of national policy alone?
I mean, I would agree with that for sure. You've said a lot, and so I want to touch on a few mm-hmm. of these things, if I may. Right. So, first of all, I agree that nuclear weapons were an easier challenge to solve, an easier coordination problem than AI will be. The best model that I've seen of how this is going to work in the AI age came a couple of years ago. I think it was 2024, a paper called Mutually Assured AI Malfunction, MAME. It was a concept developed by Dan Hendricks, Eric Schmidt, and Alex Wong, who had this long paper in Microsite. And the basic mm-hmm. theory is that AI could prove so destabilizing, and it could carry such a technical signature such that you would know it would be developed. Super intelligence, a kind of extra mythos class model capable of posing a threat to critical infrastructure, you would be able to see it coming. If you're in China or if you're in the United States, you would be able to see it coming. And so their theory is that no state understanding its capability will permit it to be developed, that likely we'll see a deliberate sabotage of the other state's national AI program in whatever form it's taking. And so basically they expect, or at least the paper forecasts, that we'll see huge cyber attacks against US national labs. And I don't think that that's out of the realm of possibility if things continue progressing. So then you invite a bigger conversation about, well, are people going to start moving data centers underground and hiding the ball and really securitizing their national AI programs and nationalizing them in a manner maybe analogous to the Manhattan Project? And I think, just to be frank with you, we're starting to see some discussions of that conversation that used to be quite fringe enter parts of the edges of the mainstream.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So I had Dan Hendricks on the podcast to talk about that paper that coined the term mutually assured AI malfunction. It was, I think the actual title of the paper was Superintelligence Strategy, maybe. Yeah. But so just to make sure people understand, the first part of the argument is that if one nation, we're basically talking about the U.S. and China here, whether they use those terms or not. If one nation is ahead and moving toward some important threshold like superintelligence that will give it utter dominance, it then would make sense for the other nation that's behind, to stage some kind of preemptive strike, maybe bomb data centers or just sabotage them via cyber means. I mean, As people are aware, China is extremely close to the factories that make all the advanced AI chips in the world. Something to keep in mind if we continue to race ahead and get well ahead of them. But so that was the first part of the scenario. And then, as I recall, the paper, they kind of floated the hope that the country that was ahead might understand that getting too far ahead might invite this kind of preemptive attack, and so might recognize that it's in its interest to either slow down and or create a more transparent environment and so on. I mean, I don't know if that's the way you read it, but I remember a certain amount of hope that the problem would solve itself, which seems to me not very likely, actually. What seems more likely to me is that the nation that's ahead races ahead and does invite the preemptive strike that may or may not happen. I mean, my takeaway from that is just another reason to start establishing some rules of the road with China so that we don't wind up in such a destabilizing situation. After all, both countries have nuclear weapons, so you wouldn't want to see a war kind of get out of hand right now. Is that your understanding of the logic of the thing?
I read the paper much more, I don't know if you would say pessimistically, but just that the state of likely mutually assured malfunction was the strategic stability that underpinned AI development. Mm-hmm. Nobody would reach super intelligence if both sides believed in the ability of crossing that threshold. And
So there would be unilateral restraint by the leader? Or
not that there would be restraint, but that there would be sabotage.
I think they did kind of float the hope, but I thought that part was not that plausible, and the proper reading of the paper overall was a dark reading, a warning.
Right. I read it pretty darkly, and mm-hmm. just looking at the way things played out, obviously there are differences in our contest with the PRC, but the U.S.-Soviet contest to develop and deploy nuclear weapons was not, a bright spot. I came to be in Washington working at different arms control and missile defense advocacy groups back when I was in college, and got a pretty robust education on both sides of the aisle about arms control. But the fact of the matter is that the Soviet Union cheated at every opportunity on almost every arms control agreement struck with the United States. There's a reason that New START has expired. There was a reason before that that the INF Treaty expired. I was in Moscow studying abroad during the expiration of the INF Treaty. And so to see Anthropic invoke the INF Treaty as a good example of multilateral coordination was a little eye-popping to me because, things fall apart and the center cannot hold.
What about the ABM, the Defensive Missile Treaty I was talking about? Was that respected?
ABM, I've got to go back in the history books, but we have a robust missile defense in this country. And in fact, it's been the source of so much consternation from the Russian side since the 2000s.
And you alluded to China wanting to keep building more nukes before they start talking about some kind of deal. It wouldn't surprise me if our development of defensive capability, anti-missile missiles, doesn't have something to do with that. But in any event, that's all in the wake of George W. Bush withdrawing from the ABM treaty. I mean, I think that treaty permitted super minimal defense, but we're beyond that now, and the treaty is no longer in force.
I want to plant one flag. I don't want your listeners to get necessarily the wrong idea to say that AI is the same as nuclear weapons, because it's not. It's a general purpose technology with huge upshot. And that's another thing that really complicates any analog with nukes or traditional arms control agreements. Mm-hmm. The idea, I guess my broader message, I'm deeply skeptical of the concept of restraining unilateral capability development in the field of AI, because people are really optimistic about the future of this technology and people are using it for tremendous upside and good. And so you really don't want to foreclose the potential to build more capable models and put them in people's hands. This has been the policy of the Trump administration, and it's been the policy of the Chinese Communist Party since at least 2024. And I think it's going to take a lot to have either side change their fundamental view of the technology.
Right. I mean, you could say there's an analogy in the sense that nuclear energy had great positive uses, but it's not that hard to distinguish between a civilian nuclear energy program in a nuclear weapons program. Whereas with AI, you train this super brain and it can do good things and bad things.
Absolutely.
So that is a challenge. Let's talk a little about, well, is there anything else you want to say about all this? I mean, it's interesting. To be honest, it's interesting to me that you're at the American Enterprise Institute. And honestly, I'm not sure what that represents, what I can and can't infer about ideology based on that with respect to China, because the China issue is a little fluid, and it's you know, I mean, AEI's reputation in the context of, say, the Middle East is hawkish, even neoconish, but there's not necessarily a strong correlation between ideology on China and ideology as it applies to other realms. I mean, foreign policy vision and how hawkish you are, but it's kind of interesting to me and encouraging, actually, that you're at AEI, which is traditionally thought of as conservative, although I know you served in the Biden administration State Department, and you're just taking seriously the idea that international governance is, we may have to explore it very seriously given the nature of this technology, because in general, the aversion to international governance has come from the right much more than the left, right?
Well, you've opened so many.
Yeah, I was wondering if I was offending you in the course of that, but
Look, let me lay out a few things. Just to be very clear, AEI very deliberately has a many voice policy. Every scholar's got their own view of the world. My fun joke to my friends is that ever since I was a child, I wanted to become a nonpartisan technocrat, and I really feel I've succeeded in that. Up to this point in time. And so I try to think seriously about the development of the technology. I am deeply skeptical of any attempts at a global governance regime for AI. I don't think that it's something that the Trump administration is going to do. And I don't think it's even something that a Democratic administration would do to willfully cede American sovereignty over the most important technology, certainly of this century, at least so far. And I think there are a lot of ways this could go wrong. Like I said, I'm deeply skeptical of anything that would constrain capability development that is imposed from an outside force. Mm-hmm. I think what we're likely to see, what I advocate for, what I would like to see, and what I express, you know, to meetings with Chinese friends and in my briefings with people in the U.S. government, I think we should aim for some kind of coordination of our respective domestic approaches to governing AI. I mean, basically, it's in the United States' interest to make sure that AI labs in China are vetting their models with the National Cybersecurity Center in China to make sure that they can't be used by malicious actors for bioterrorism or cyber attacks mm-hmm. or non-state actors. Mm-hmm. At the same time, obviously, you know, I don't think it's, I don't trust the Chinese government. I don't know many people in Washington who do. And so I don't think it makes sense to like share our most precious state secrets to develop this technology. At the same time, you know, we want to make sure that we're rowing our respective ships of state in roughly the same direction.
Yeah, I mean, I would say that I think on the Chinese side, there are people there who can cite reasons that they don't trust the U.S. government, and I could actually give you some reasons, I think. But in any event, let me ask you how you think they are viewing this Mythos thing. Most people probably heard it's this model that Anthropic hasn't released yet because it's apparently dangerously powerful. Its ability to detect and in some cases exploit previously undetected vulnerabilities. There was a report in the Financial Times recently that the U.S. government is using it, is now using, you know, it has access to Mythos in the first instance to check government systems for bugs. And of course, Anthropic has made the model available to a lot of the big institutional actors, including companies that maintain important parts of infrastructure like Microsoft, Google. But the report in the FT was that the U.S. government is now using Mythos in offensive cyber hacking operations. And there was the suggestion that people at Anthropic are are helping. I don't know how clear they were in asserting that, but apparently there are people in Anthropic helping the government with some stuff related to Mythos. And in any event, the upshot of the report was that we're using this offensively against, well, they didn't say, they mentioned Iran and China as the likely recipients of the offense, but they didn't say that, right? I mean, you probably read the piece more closely than I did and may want to correct me on something, but I am in any event wondering how you think China views this Mythos thing. God knows it's occurred to China that the U.S. government may be using it, right, offensively. I mean, it's the job of certain people in Chinese government to worry about this kind of stuff, and countries pretty reliably do worry about this kind of stuff. So I'm wondering what you think China may be thinking, maybe even doing in response to the Mythos thing. And again, feel free to kind of refine my presentation of that, what that FT report said.
No, I think you summarized the FT report that I saw pretty well. Excuse me.
Yeah, but you are heroically showing up in spite of having a cold or something. And
I am recovering.
A grateful nation thanks you.
I'm good.
I was this close to dialing 911. I'm glad you pulled through.
Me too. So to get to the real stuff, you know, AI and hacking. You know, on your question, how's China viewing this? I don't think that anything reported in the media over the past couple of months would have changed the fundamental calculation of policymakers in Beijing, right? I mean, if I'm sitting in Beijing, I have to assume that U.S. frontier AI labs are working closely with the federal government in the United States, which has not been a secret at all. I mean, everybody knows, based on other media reporting, that mm-hmm. Claude has been instrumental in Department of War operations in Iran, as well as back in Venezuela in January. And we know, just based on public statements from the company, that they aspire to support the defense mission of the United States. At the same time, you know, what I caution the Chinese friends and what is true is Anthropic is a private company. It does what it wants, and it speaks independently of the U.S. government. Certainly, it doesn't share every viewpoint held by the U.S. Department of War, with which it's been in a blood feud over 2026. Mm-hmm. And I don't think that's going to change anytime soon. But I think that, excuse me.
That's okay.
I think that the Chinese side has to assume that it's vulnerable to any frontier model releases that could emanate from the United States or any other state. And I think the Chinese Communist Party is correctly concerned about AI's proliferation, misuse, and abuse. At least that's been the stated mm-hmm. position of some regulators in China. And so China is thinking seriously about how it will thwart some of the threats AI will pose to China's critical infrastructure, just as the U.S. government is thinking about the same. And this is actually creating a shared opportunity to coordinate what will be, I think, very similar approaches to AI's regulation in both countries.
Mm-hmm. Okay. The reason I ask is because, of course, it is famously the case that along, you know, some armaments dimensions, at least, there can be danger in a nation being unsure about how threatened it is. It can provoke, you know, kind of rash action, you might say. And nuclear weapons is the most famous case. Like, if you're sitting there thinking, for all we know, America does have this system that could totally neutralize a retaliatory capacity, maybe we should act in some way preemptively if we have that option. So in other words, sometimes transparency can be stabilizing, and kind of being in the dark about exactly how powerful what the adversary has is and how they might use it can in principle be destabilizing. So I was kind of wondering about this in that context, because I'm sure China has always thought, well, yeah, the U.S. government is using what it has access to do what it can to spy on us and maybe more. And it probably has access to whatever these AI labs are creating. But I don't think it was ever quite demonstrated so clearly that if so, the U.S. government now has something that's probably appreciably more advanced than anything China has. I was just wondering about whether the perception of that asymmetry could be destabilizing. I don't have a really clear-cut scenario where it is. I was just wondering.
I mean, I don't think you're going to like my answer on this one, Bob, but my feeling is just that, you know, perception is perception and it's bound to be the case. I mean, I'm glad that it's this way and not the reverse, right? I'm glad that it's the United States that has a qualitative edge in this technology, at least for the time being, and I'd like for that to remain the case. And so I advocate policies that I think will make that remain the case. Certainly, it creates some form of what you would call strategic instability or first strike instability, right? You can kind of think of different kinds of strategic instability in terms of an arms race dynamic mm-hmm. at a meta level, or in terms of like an arm, you know, a first strike, a kind of mutually assured AI malfunction and actually an incentive to degrade the other side's AI program. I think that incentive exists today. Mm-hmm. The president has been super clear that, you know, China hacks the United States and the United States engages in similar activity. He hasn't mm-hmm. Pretended otherwise. You know, he's kind of let the polite veneer yeah. fall by the wayside.
He's refreshing in that way. he's unlike other presidents sometimes, yes.
That's certainly the case. But, you know, I think this is going to necessitate a pretty big rethink in U.S. strategic planning writ large. You know, mm-hmm. I come from the arms control nuclear policy world. Many of those people are trying to get involved in discussions about AI policy today. I always caution them. And I say, I don't think this is your lane. I don't think that this is a conversation that's ripe for a discussion of unilateral willingness not to develop certain capabilities. I don't think that's the answer. I don't think it's going to happen. And I don't think it's a good idea. But I will say one area where we really could use some modeling and thinking is about deterrence incentives, right? If you read the main paper like you and I have been, Bob, if it's in a kind of negative light and that we think that both sides are going to start, you know, taking actions to preclude the other's development of AI in a very serious way, where does that leave us?
Mm-hmm.
What will the US reaction be if a major AI lab is seriously imperiled, its operations are imperiled, its training run is disrupted actively by an actor that we can attribute to be from China? What will the US government do? I don't know if we have thought seriously enough about that outcome. And I'll just, you know, I'm not saying this is the answer by any means, but I'll just flag for your listeners. There was a huge debate way back in 2018 when the first Trump administration unveiled its nuclear posture review. And then Undersecretary of Defense John Rood went on the record and said that it was within the U.S. right to consider deploying a nuclear weapon in response to a massive cyber attack on U.S. critical infrastructure. People mm-hmm. at that time thought that was pretty out there as a policy move, that the U.S. would consider using nukes in response to cyber attacks.
Mm-hmm.
That's the kind of level of thinking that is rearing its ugly head in policy debates, I think, in 2026.
Mm-hmm. Did you say that was a Trump initiative? That declaration?
That was a change in wording in the nuclear posture review from the first Trump administration back in 2018. And I haven't seen a lot of discussion about that since then, but I want to decouple these issues of AI mm-hmm. and nukes. I don't think they're going to be related. I don't think the U.S. is going to nuke China, you know, if basically under any circumstance. But that beside the point, the U.S. is and should be thinking harder about what will happen if China actively attempts to degrade America's AI capabilities. There are already reports about an astroturfing influence campaign being promulgated by China against American data center buildouts. But what if more active measures are taken? What will the United States do? I'm not sure.
Apparently they want us, the administration wants to send the signal that China should not assume something very dramatic and bad won't happen. And I'm sure the logic behind saying there could be a nuclear retaliation is that, you know, it could be stabilizing in a certain sense to send that signal, leaving aside the question of whether you have to follow up on it when push comes to shove, that just saying it could prove an effective deterrent. Sometimes then you say these things and you feel, you know, and your bluff is called and you see what happens. Anyway, so I want to keep talking, but we have reached a part of the conversation when we go into overtime, which is available to paid subscribers of the Non-Zero newsletter. Link in the show notes can magically convert you into one, or you can just go to nonzero.org and look for this post. And Ryan, you've been kind enough to say that you will stick around, talk some more. And that's good, because I want to keep talk a little more about this, about the extent to which how strong the logic is or isn't for, new kinds of agreements with China and maybe ultimately with other countries. I also want to, as I said, get into this open source question. It's a fascinating fact that as of now, at least, China's very invested in the open source, technically open weights model. That has a lot of implications. Some people say these things are inherently just asking for trouble and real mischief by non-state actors, for example, because there's so much more malleable than the proprietary models. I'm going to get into all that. But first, I want to remind people that your Substack is called Choosing Victory.
That's right.
Just evidence that you have a better marketing sensibility than me. I probably would have called mine like Choosing a Loss or something, but no, this is better. Victory, it's like more upbeat. It's more positive. This is why I should always use a consultant when I choose a name. And you are at AEI and also Georgetown University. Is there anything else you want to say? Well, you're on Twitter, for example. What's your Twitter handle?
I'm on Twitter at Ryan Fedashek. And I run, like I said, this AI news service called Digital Embassy. You can see it at digitalembassy.net.
That's very entrepreneurial, I got to say. Well, it's the American Enterprise Institute, right? Entrepreneurship is embedded in the very institution. So great. So we'll keep this conversation going into overtime. Thanks, everybody who has followed us this far. Hope you'll follow us.